The following presentation was recorded in 1998 at the Faith Builders Workshops on Child Development. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Okay, I have a few odds and ends here to share with you. A little bit on the lighter side and historical side. You've maybe seen this list, I think I've heard it a time or two before. Rules and regulations for teachers in 1872. How many of you? You? Number one, teachers each day will fill lamps, clean chimneys, and trim wicks. Each teacher will bring a bucket of water and a scuttle of coal for the day's sessions. Number three, make your pens carefully. You may whittle nibs to the individual taste of pupils. Number four, men teachers may take one evening each week for courting purposes, or two evenings a week if they go to church regularly. How's that for motivation? Number five, after 10 hours in school, the teachers spend the remaining time reading the Bible or other good books. That's not a bad rule yet. Number six, women teachers who marry or engage in unseemly conduct will be dismissed. They need to reword that. They call marriage unseemly conduct, I think. Number seven, each teacher should lay aside from each day a goodly sum of his earnings for his benefit during his declining years so he will not become a burden on society. There you have a retirement plan. Any teacher who smokes, uses liquor in any form, frequents pool or public halls, or gets shaved in a barber shop will give good reason to suspect his worth, intentions, integrity, and honesty. Number nine, the teacher who performs his labors faithfully and without fault for 5 years will be given an increase of 25 cents per week in his pay. Okay. And they say some things never change, right? Well, I don't want to complain. Someone, I think it was Erasmus, that said that people say that teaching is a lowly profession, but he says teaching is a higher profession than any king or noble because it is the teacher who influences the king or the noble when he's being taught. Well, we've been talking about family issues some and how children develop and how we grow, change. Some humor to this chart, but it has a element of truth as well. This is how fathers mature. How fathers mature. At 4 years, my daddy can do anything. When you're 7 years old, my dad knows a whole lot. When you're 9 years, dad doesn't know quite everything. Okay. 12 years, dad just doesn't understand. 14 years old, dad is old-fashioned. 21, that man is out of touch. At 25 years of age, you know, dad's okay. And at 30, I wonder what dad thinks about this. And at 35, I must get dad's input first. 50, what would dad have thought about that? And at 60 years, I wish I could talk it over with dad once more. I was just outside the other day working, and it hit me that I wish I could talk to dad about that. Or I should give dad a call. Let me finish an outline I started yesterday, and I knew when I printed up the overhead, I thought this seemed short. I thought I had more points than this. I'd worked over this before. And I flipped over my sheet last night and found three more. Let me just share them with you quickly. On character development, how conviction is developed. Maybe you can find that spot in your notes. How conviction is developed. And these three, they're just important enough that I wanted to share them with you. And this is especially true on an adult level. I'm speaking more to you than I am to you about your students on this. Number five on that list, sometimes convictions are the result of life in a community of spiritually minded people who have a covenant to live in a certain way for the mutual benefit of everyone. Now, I like that point especially because it wasn't written by a Mennonite author. All right? I'm thinking, okay, well, most of our Anabaptist churches would have that approach as part of our model for growing convictions and being accountable for who we are and for our lives and how we live. And it develops conviction. Number six, convictions are also formed out of the consequences of failure. And think about this, whether the failure is simply a bad day when you weren't prepared to teach, or whether it's a student that you feel you've fundamentally failed, or perhaps it's a personal failure that you've demonstrated in your own life. And it's at those moments that, of course, many things come into our minds. We want to quit. We think we want to go hide in a hole. We're sure that everybody thinks we're a farce. And any number of things, that feelings that come along in failure. But here, he gives some questions, he says, that drive the teaching of failure. You can let failure take you out of the race. And remember, I quoted the proverb of the day, a good man falls seven times and gets up again. It's not so much how many times you fall, it's how many times you get up. And so here's some questions that I think you need to ask yourself when you're struggling with failure. Just ask yourself, what does my failure mean? What does it mean? What does my failure mean? And then, what weakness does it reveal in my nature, who I am? What weakness does it reveal? Okay, and I think most of us, if we see certain kinds of failure more than once, we kind of know the answer to that question. We see the weakness that it reveals. And then to ask the question, what conviction will I form to prevent this failure from happening again? What conviction will I form? What needs to change? What do I need to hold fast to in order for this not to happen again? And how will I use the lessons of this failure to be of value to me and others in the future? Now that's difficult. That sounds like a real nice, pious approach to my failure. But you know what? If you really live that, it's a selfless approach because it requires you to give up your own reputation and who you are and be willing to share that failure and its consequences in your life with other people. And that's not fun. At least if you want to hang on to your own reputation. So how will you use that lesson to be of value to you and others in the future? That means you're honest about it. You say it like it is. You don't pull any punches. And then number seven, convictions are developed on the basis of regular self-examination. Psalm 139, search me, O God, know my heart. Try me, know my thoughts. See if there be any wicked way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting. How many of you have heard the story of Teddy Stollard? Okay, a few of you, some more of you might recognize it when I read it. Let me read it to you this morning. It's entitled Three Letters from Teddy. Teddy's letter came today, and now that I've read it, I will place it in my cedar chest with the other things that are important to my life. I wanted you to be the first to know. I smiled as I read the words he had written, and my heart swelled with a pride that I had no right to feel. I have not seen Teddy Stollard since he was a student in my fifth grade class 15 years ago. It was early in my career, and I had only been teaching for 2 years. From the first day he stepped into my classroom, I disliked Teddy. Teachers, although everyone knows differently, are not supposed to have favorites in a class. But most especially are they not to show dislike for a child, any child. Nevertheless, every year there are one or two children that one cannot help but be attached to, For teachers are human, and it is human nature to like bright, pretty, intelligent people, whether they are 10 years old or 25. And sometimes, not too often, fortunately, there will be one or two students to whom the teacher just can't seem to relate. I had thought myself quite capable of handling my personal feelings along that line until Teddy walked into my life. There wasn't a child I particularly liked that year, but Teddy was most assuredly one I disliked. He was dirty, not just occasionally, but all the time. His hair hung low over his ears, and he actually had to hold it out of his eyes as he wrote his papers in class. And this was before it was fashionable to do so. Two, he had a peculiar odor about him which I could never quite identify. His physical faults were many, and his intellect left a lot to be desired also. By the end of the first week, I knew he was hopelessly behind the others. Not only was he behind, he was just plain slow. I began to withdraw from him immediately. Any teacher will tell you that it's more of a pleasure to teach a bright child. It is definitely more rewarding for one's ego. But any teacher worth her credentials can channel work to the bright child, keeping him challenged and learning, while she puts her major effort on the slower ones. Any teacher can do this. Most teachers do it, but I didn't. Not that year. In fact, I concentrated on my best students and let the others follow along as best they could. Ashamed as I am to admit it, I took perverse pleasure in using my red pen, and each time I came to Teddy's papers, the cross marks, and they were many, were always a little larger and a little redder than necessary. "Poor work," I would write with a flourish. While I did not actually ridicule the boy, my attitude was obviously quite apparent to the class, for he quickly became the class goat, the outcast, the unlovable, and the unloved. He knew I didn't like him, but he didn't know why. Nor did I know, then or now, why I felt such an intense dislike for him. All I know is that he was a little boy no one cared about, and I made no effort in his behalf. The days rolled by. We made it through the fall festival and the Thanksgiving holidays, and I continued marking happily with my red pen. As the Christmas holidays approached, I knew that Teddy would never catch up in time to be promoted to the sixth grade level. He would be a repeater. To justify myself, I went to his cumulative folder from time to time. He had very low grades for the first 4 years, but no grade failure. How he had made it, I didn't know. I closed my mind to the personal remarks. First grade, Teddy shows promise by work and attitude, but has poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy could do better. Mother terminally ill. He receives little help at home. Third grade, Teddy is a pleasant boy, helpful, but too serious. Slow learner, mother passed away end of the year. Fourth grade, very slow, but well behaved. Father shows no interest. Well, they passed him four times, but he will certainly repeat fifth grade. Do him good, I said to myself. And then the last day before the holiday arrived, our little tree on the reading table sported paper and popcorn chains. Many gifts were heaped underneath, waiting for the big moment. Teachers always get several gifts at Christmas, but mine that year seemed bigger and more elaborate than ever. There was not a student who had not brought me one. Each unwrapping brought squeals of delight, and the proud giver would receive effusive thank yous. His gift wasn't the last one I picked up. In fact, it was in the middle of the pile. Its wrapping was a brown paper bag, and he had colored Christmas trees and red balls all over it. It was stuck together with masking tape. "For Miss Thompson, from Teddy," it read. The group was completely silent, and for the first time I felt conspicuous, embarrassed because they all stood watching me unwrap that gift. As I removed the last bit of masking tape, two items fell to my desk: a gaudy rhinestone bracelet with several stones missing, and a small bottle of dime store cologne, half empty. I could hear the snickers and whispers, and I wasn't sure I could look at Teddy. "Isn't this lovely?" I asked, placing the bracelet on my wrist. "Teddy, would you help me fasten it?" He smiled shyly as he fixed the clasp, and I held up my wrist for all of them to admire. There were a few hesitant oohs and ahs, but as I dabbed the cologne behind my ears, all the little girls lined up for a dab behind their ears. I continued to open the gifts until I reached the bottom of the pile. We ate our refreshments and the bell rang. The children filed out with shouts of "See you next year" and "Merry Christmas," but Teddy waited at his desk. When they had all left, he walked toward me, clutching his gift and books to his chest. "You smell just like Mom," he said softly. "Her bracelet looks real pretty on you, too. I'm glad you liked it." He left quickly. I locked the door, sat down at my desk, and wept, resolving to make up to Teddy what I had deliberately deprived him of, a teacher who cared. I stayed every afternoon with Teddy from the end of Christmas holidays until the last day of school. Sometimes we worked together, sometimes he worked alone while I drew up lesson plans or graded papers. Slowly but surely he caught up with the rest of the class. Gradually there was a definite upward curve in his grades. He did not have to repeat the fifth grade. In fact, his final averages were among the highest in the class. And although I knew he would be moving out of the state when school was out, I was not worried for him. Teddy had reached a level that would stand him in good stead the following year, no matter where he went. He had enjoyed a measure of success, and as we were taught in our teacher training courses, success builds success. I did not hear from Teddy until 7 years later, when his first letter appeared in my mailbox. "Dear Miss Thompson, I just wanted you to be the first to know. I will be graduating second in my class next month. Very truly yours, Teddy Stollard." I sent him a card of congratulations and a small package, a pen and pencil gift set. I wondered what he would do after graduation. 4 years later, Teddy's second letter came. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. I was just informed that I'll be graduating first in my class. The university has not been easy, but I liked it. Very truly yours, Teddy Stollard." I sent him a good pair of sterling silver monogram cufflinks and a card. So proud of him I could burst. And now today, Teddy's third letter. "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know. As of today, I'm Theodore J. Stollard, M.D. How about that? I'm going to be married in July, the 27th, to be exact. I wanted to ask if you could come and sit where Mom would sit if she were here. I'll have no family there as Dad died last year. Very truly yours, Ted Stollard." I'm not sure what kind of gift one sends to a doctor on completion of medical school and state boards. Maybe I'll just wait and take a wedding gift, but my note can't wait. "Dear Ted, congratulations, you made it. And you did it yourself. In spite of those like me and not because of us, this day has come for you. God bless you. I'll be at that wedding with bells on." Well, I know sometimes we wish that all of our stories would end that well. But that's the kind of teacher I want to be for people who don't have all the opportunities that I've had. I brought a few books up, and I feel a little bit like I'm taking advantage of this workshop here, trying to sell books, but I think I justify myself by saying I'd recommend these whether I ran a bookstore or not. I really do recommend these books, whether you buy them here or somewhere else. Just a word of explanation about the bookstore. We started it, Steve Brubaker and myself and a couple other men have been involved, just trying to take all the options you have as teachers out there. You can get stacks of catalogs in your school, and everybody's telling you, this is it, this is dynamite, you got to have this. Well, what we want to do is talk to good teachers and take a look at what has worked well for us and be able to market those at a discount price, better than you can find it anywhere else, is what our goal is, and make those available so that when you look at what's down there, you know that it's probably good stuff and that more than just one or two teachers has used it and thought it was good material. So we want to add things like science lab equipment to where you could come here and pick up basic science equipment, especially materials like sulfuric acid and hydrochloric acid and other things. And we're working with a company where we want to be able to simply have them drop ship those materials right to your school. and you can get it at a better price through us than you could if you ordered directly from them. So if you want to stay in touch with what we're doing and developing, we want to have it more than just books and art supplies, not so much supplies as resources, and then books, science things, computers, use computers. So all those things, we know how schools and teachers operate on tight budgets. It's that 25-cent pay raise every 5 years, you know. So we want to try to help people as much as we can. And be sure you sign up for a catalog if you want to stay in touch with what's happening there. It will not always be in the FB flyer. Faith Builders was very interested in helping us out and providing a platform for us to do that, simply because it's what Faith Builders is about as well. So let me just show you the two books that I would recommend highly for first-year teachers. This Teaching to Change Lives, I just think every teacher ought to have a copy of that. And then this book, How to Be an Effective Teacher, The First Days of School. It's not a Christian author. They're Japanese, I believe, and their efficiency and work ethic comes through in the book. And the book, I wish I would have had it my first year, because if you take this book and put it to work, it will, I believe, pay big dividends. They have five basic units: the teacher, and then characteristics of the teacher, positive expectations, classroom management, lesson mastery, and then the teacher as professional. And they talk about how to write good objectives, how to structure a lesson, how to teach a lesson people will learn, how to structure your classroom in terms of discipline, how to manage it in terms of time and schedule. A first-rate book, lots of pictures, good graphics, summaries of main points, so that you can flip through and just be stimulated into some good thinking there. So I'd recommend that very highly. It's not cheap, but I think it's a book that you'll find yourself pulling out year after year. Another book, if you read a lot to your students, and I know most of you do, but this book, Teaching Children, includes a curriculum guide, especially developed for homeschool moms and maybe for elementary schools if they want to use their material. So they have curriculum, but it's basically based on the teaching of Charlotte Mason, who was a 19th century English teacher who has just done some outstanding work. And they talk about, there's chapters in here, how to teach reading, language arts overview, and they talk about narration. And that by that, they simply mean getting children to retell the stories. A lot of your reading curriculum material will often have questions. And children often will grow up not really caring for reading class because they all have to answer those nasty questions at the end, you know. Well, especially for young children, they give a way through what they call narration to let you stay abreast of what the child is actually comprehending and learning, and it gets them to talk about the story. So you know a good story with characters and plot and conflict and conflict resolution, climax, all those elements of a good story. If a child can retell it and demonstrate an understanding and a grasp of those critical elements of the story, you know there's been significant comprehension and memory. And they talk about the fact that you can read lots and lots of stories to your children, and then a week later say, okay, who can remember the story of ta-da? And okay, why don't you tell us that story? And at the end of a week, as you work on this over a period of time, they will become very good at remembering and telling those stories, which is really what we're after. So that's just one example. They also talk about a Christian worldview, what it means to be a Christian, talk about teaching social studies, developing a Christian mind, science, all those things are in there. And plus it will give you an idea with their curriculum guide, what should a fourth grade person know. It'll give you titles of books, titles of poems that I'll be memorized, that I'll be familiar with. You could almost structure your classroom right out of this book. But it also gives you short chapters on different subjects that I think are stimulating. But here's another book, Excellence in Teaching with the Seven Laws. It's a shortened version of The Seven Laws by John Milton Gregory. And also an excellent book. Again, very accessible. You can pick it up and read it in 5 minutes, find something that will help you sharpen your skills as a teacher. All right, this morning I want to be done a little early. How many of you would enjoy a discussion group yet this morning? Okay, number of you? All right. Anything particular you want to talk about? Okay. Well, I have a couple ideas, but if you think of something, be sure you mention it. I want to talk about several things this morning. I want to talk about motivation in children, especially in the context of learning. And then I want to address classroom discipline and talk about discipline and give you 9 steps on developing a strong discipline program. How many of you have read the book Classroom Discipline by Ollie Gibbs and Jerry Haddock? ACSI publishes it. Have I seen the book? Okay, then I won't be repeating anything you already know, at least out of that book. You talk about how to earn your students' respect. I mentioned that earlier this week, that you need to earn respect. And then I want to wrap it up with a few thoughts on you as a teacher. Okay. Ruth Beechick, in her book, A Biblical Psychology of Learning, which is now out of print, I think the summer class in child development used this book as one of the texts. She gives a model for learning, how learning takes place. And so she begins with parental love and discipline, because Proverbs says the beginning of knowledge is the fear of the Lord. Okay? So she begins with this element of fear. And she does it through parental love and discipline. Now, let me just show you the model here. Notice, I'm going to start at the top here. Notice that she has head and heart at the top. Western thought, Western civilization has typically emphasized the head. All right? We are big on knowledge and information. And we talked about that. If we can just educate people enough, they'll live right. So we're big on the head. The Jewish model really has been one of the heart. And the Bible mentions the heart directly. I think she mentions 800 times. And since then, I know that she's come up with a couple hundred more that she has found that are references to the same word or idea as heart. And so the Hebrew idea of the central part of the person has been the heart. And what we have ended up with in modern times is that we have divorced the head and the heart. And so biblically, we want to put those back together. What I mean by the heart is motivation, thoughts, intent, those things. And the head is simply that intellectual side, the knowing side. Okay, so she begins down here in the lower right-hand corner. Parental love and discipline. And notice there's arrows leaving this. And this is information learning. We could put that on the same number one level of knowledge that we talked about on Bloom's taxonomy, the knowledge level. It also comes over here to concept learning, which is level 2, comprehension and beyond. And then it comes up here and we have heart set. It's what she calls the heart set or self-discipline. And all of these interplay with each other. So there's interaction between all of them. Well, let's look at what she means by parental love and discipline. It's the beginning point. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. A father's discipline teaches the child the fear of the Lord. A father's discipline. And there's quite an interesting discussion on this whole idea of fear and respect. You know, the Bible says the fear of the Lord. And so in the Old Testament especially, we have different prophets saying, telling the people, fear the Lord, fear ye him. Well, what does that word fear mean? Does that mean we quake in mortal dread and terror before God? Not really. What it really, it could also mean respect, a fundamental, if you respect someone, in this biblical sense, that means you order your life around what you know to be true about that person. And so fear and respect are learned from parents and teachers, that and that respect can then be transferred to God. A child who has had a fear of God instilled into him brings with him an ability to apply himself to the work of learning. Because now, with this fear of God, he's no longer living life out of his own definitions and resources. He's living like God wants him to live. So he is ready to apply himself. Well, then we look at the heart set and self-discipline. The growth of self-discipline is gradual. I think we all know that. It's on again, off again. Sometimes we're just delighted with the progress people make. And then other times we think they'll never grow up. Adults should allow freedom when the child handles it well and impose structure and discipline when he needs it. So when you know, and you do this as a teacher, you know that a certain student can handle certain situations and you give him permission to do it. Another student may ask you the same thing. You say, well, no, I think maybe you ought to have some, you know, and you give him something else to do. You know that it's not going to happen, or you increase the amount of supervision that that student has in order to do that. We just have those kind of students. With self-discipline, a person can learn at all levels. In other words, the point here is that age is not as fundamental a factor in deciding when a student can learn something. If a student has had parental love and discipline and has therefore developed a heart set, they are equipped to learn tremendously. And so some of the things that we may think are not age appropriate or age capable, they can pick up. Learning increases discipline. Discipline increases learning. Think about some of your best students, even the ones that are not overly intelligent. I've had students who were very average in mental capacity, and yet they were fantastic students because they had tremendous discipline. There was a very rich, deep security in their home life, and they knew love, they knew parental discipline, and their heart set was just completely focused, and therefore they were fantastic students. They loved to learn. They wanted to learn. They were pushing themselves beyond what their school ability test that we gave at the end of the year in every other grade, the Otis Lennon school ability test. I was always amazed at how low they ranked on that ability test with how well their grades were and with how well they did on the achievement test, because they had this heart set that we're talking about here. Learning increases discipline. Discipline increases learning. The conscience, the will, purpose, and determination are associated with the heart and play their part in learning. The conscience, that sense of right and wrong, the will, the purpose, determination, all of these are heart issues. Now think about this. We try to motivate people to learn, don't we? And we try to craft in such a way that they will learn. Well, here's what we're talking about. Conscience, And I love what Melvin mentioned the night, I believe it was this week, where he said that to stir a student, so we talk about motivation, to stir their sense of justice, right and wrong, and it will increase their motivation to learn. That's what we're talking about here. Conscience, will, purpose, and determination. Okay, information learning then. So now we move to just knowing the facts, knowing the stuff, information. And here we have rote learning, we have association learning. It's level one, and it does not equal low value. Level one does not equal low value. It may be lower in complexity, but it's not lower in value because you have to know something in order to think about it. Seems like a simplistic statement, doesn't it? And then we move to concept learning, which would be level two. Having insight and understanding beyond the facts of level one. It's seeing relationships among facts in level one. Saying, oh, so this here means that this over here is going to respond this way. Or that's what this means over here. It's going to give insight. It's the aha experience. I get it. Oh, I see. Moving from level one to level two is the discovery. Moving from level one to level two is discovery. What I mean by that is that the big rage today, the process content debate, should you learn how to think, how to process information, or should you learn content? And here we're saying that part of the joy of learning, the joy of discovery, is right here in moving from level one to level two. Age and subject matter are not factors which determine level. Here again, we're saying that if a child has this basic heart set and knows parental love and discipline, it's amazing what they can learn. And that's why I believe a well-organized homeschool, that's why you see some of those children advancing far beyond their grade level, is because some of these things are in place. And mom and dad can do a good job in some of those areas. And then number five, wise self-direction. Here is the culmination of learning. You know the facts. You've experienced parental love and discipline. You have the fear of the Lord, the respect. And you have developed a heart set toward God, self-discipline. You learn information and you begin to see relationships between areas of knowledge and knowing. And when you put the two together, you have wise self-direction. Creativity. The heart set and learning merge into wisdom, Proverbs 9:9. The student can take charge of his own learning. He's motivated. He wants to learn. He has a heart for God. He wants to do what's right. And the desire comes from the heart set motivation side. And that's this over here. The heart set side. That's where motivation comes from. Combined with the knowledge side, combining those two allows him to work creatively. Creatively. We wonder sometimes why we're not creative. These two sides need to come together. Well, let's talk about classroom discipline. You're going to struggle as a teacher, and if you've taught for a long time, you already know this. You're constantly trying to figure out how you can motivate students. And that's why whenever I find anything on motivation, I lap it up, because it's a constant battle. I'm trying to figure out, if I could just reach inside, if I could just unzip their head and wiggle the wires, you know, maybe I could make this thing work. That's what motivation is all about. Gibbs and Haddock and for the basis for this book, Classroom Discipline, interviewed 442 teachers, surveyed 442. And they asked them what kinds of problems they have in their classroom. What are the top five problems in your classroom? When they collated their results, I didn't bring it with me this morning, but it was things like, you can imagine, talking, defiance, getting out of the seat without permission, some of those things. Now, those are exactly, those are exactly the problems, the top five in public schools back in 1940. The top five in public schools today, in 1990, I believe it was, were things like rape, aggravated assault, and the list goes on from there. How did we get there? Well, that's a whole other discussion. But when we think about classroom discipline, we want to think, like I mentioned today, it's discipleship. Discipline is discipleship. And when you go to design your program, your goal is to continue the process of developing discipline in a student and working on that heart set, that ability to discipline themselves and to do what is right and to want to do what is right. Not just because it pays off in your classroom to do what is right, even though it may you may need some of that motivation, but you also want that internal motivation to do what's right. So let's look at some components that they suggest. Praise, encouragement, and support should be a focal point of all classroom discipline. Think about that. Praise, encouragement, and support. If you can establish a positive climate in your classroom, positive, forward-moving, purposeful, supportive, growing atmosphere. And you do that through praise, encouragement, and just plain communicating the fact that I like you. I like you. I think you're a great person. I enjoy you as a person. And your praise and encouragement support reflects that basic mindset. I like you. And part of what makes the story about Teddy Stollard so moving, I think, is that I know I've had students that I didn't really like. I didn't like them. Very honestly, I did not like them. And yet I was called to love them and pray for them, and encourage, support. And so I need to communicate that, whether I feel it or not. I work very hard to communicate, I like you. Okay. I had a student my first 2 years of teaching who had that peculiar smell, and she was a gal who came from a very poor home. I don't know that the marriage was all that poor, but economically they were very poor and very sloppy, shoddy appearance. School was a struggle. Long fingernails, you know, that weren't clean underneath. Her skin didn't look clean. It wasn't nice skin. Her hands, she wasn't clean, and it smelled. Hair all over the place, disheveled, and a huge brownish covering kind of stacked on top of it all. Well, you can imagine students didn't really like it either, didn't like her. By the way, my comment there on a huge covering there, I'm just saying, I think you know what I mean, it just didn't fit her. Nothing wrong with the huge covering. I'm just saying that it just contributed to the appearance rather than helped it. She wasn't from a Mennonite home. But that's probably irrelevant in terms of the issues. But the bottom line was, she knew she wasn't liked all that well. Very bubbly person, tried to compensate by being friendly and very insecure. And I remember going on the senior trip in D.C., and the one day we always dressed up because we met with our senator or representative that one day. And I think this is my first year of teaching because it's the first time I was out in D.C. with a class. So I had asked them to dress up, but we were doing a lot of walking that day. You know how it is in dress shoes. I mean, they're not designed for 5 hours of concrete and asphalt, you know. And her feet were just killing her. I mean, we're walking around the Capitol building, you know, and all these great places. Everybody's dressed up around you going somewhere. And we're walking through there. And we're dressed up more than your average tourist, you know. And but she starts lagging behind because her feet are hurting so bad, and she starts to cry. And so I told her, hey, just carry your, take your shoes off. I mean, there's all kinds of people walking the streets here anyway. Just take your shoes off and walk barefoot, because her shoes were killing her. Well, what's my point? My point is, this person was just not someone you wanted to walk with even on the street. You know, you just did not want to be with this person. And yet, by God's grace, we have to minister to those people. We cannot retreat. You have to be willing to endure some things like smell and loss of what you feel is reputation, all of those things. And an atmosphere of praise, encouragement, support. Use positive reinforcement. Many times we'll post consequences for misbehavior. Okay? We'll post consequences. But we will not very often post consequences for good behavior. So, in this book, and I'm just giving you one small chunk of it. This book is an excellent book. But they talk about posting consequences for positive behavior. And you can include. Start with the most important ones. Right out of Scripture. That he who fears, that he heeds instruction will be wise. Or the Lord will bless this person. There's Proverbs all over that you can find. Promises for those who keep instruction, who listen, who have a wise ear and heart. Start with that and move to things like a friendly disposition. Those things are going to follow when a person has a wise heart and ear. Proverbs says that he who, if I can quote it now, he who loves a pure heart and pure speech, or a gracious speech is the idea there, will have the king for his friend. All right, so post those. Letter C, the majority of discipline problems in the classroom occur for one of two reasons. I like this. Only one or two reasons why you have the majority of the problems you do. Your discipline program is inadequate. You haven't adequately thought through the issues. How am I going to maintain order in this classroom? How am I going to do it? In this book, they spell it all out, very detailed. Number two, implementation of the program is ineffective. You're not implementing the program. One of those two reasons why we have problems in our classrooms. Another issue in program design, you need to have clearly defined standards and consistent follow-through. We've talked about that before. Clearly defined standards is a matter of organization and goal setting for you personally, for your students in your classroom. And then the consistent follow-through, folks, is a character issue. It reflects you. It really does. And I'm as uncomfortable with that as you are. It reflects you. Well, here they give some things that teachers say about effective discipline. What are some components of effective discipline? Flexibility. You have to be flexible. You have your program, you're consistent, but you have a sense of when to flex. Now, that's a tough one for me. Some people are naturals at this. They just have this internal sense of people and what's important and how relationships are and what will work and what won't. I'll just be honest, I don't feel like I have a very good sense of that. If I set a program up, I tend to run it pretty tight, pretty hard. If once I say I'm going to do something, then I try to do it. But I'm not always very flexible. So flexibility is an issue. When you find someone who seems to be able to have great control in the classroom, but they don't seem to have to work very hard to get it, You need to watch that person. You need to figure out how they do it. Figure out, what is it? And I guarantee you this issue of flexibility would be part of it. They just kind of have this way to feel, it feels relaxed. It feels like they know when to bend a little, and yet there's very clear expectations. And that's number two, set your expectations. Number three is the negative side. There is not inconsistency in effective discipline. Inconsistency is not a part of it. But number four, you do have consistency. Day after day, even as you wear down in the grind of the school year and you get to know those students very well, they get to know you, you get a little tired, you lose your focus, you've got to stay consistent. Remember, if you lose it by March, come May, when the sun shines and the flowers bloom, and you've lost control, you're in trouble. Complacency. I've just been talking about that. You cannot become complacent. Number six, perseverance. Perseverance. Hanging in there for the long haul. Through February, through March, through April, into the end of the school year. And number seven, selectivity. Have few rules and be 100% consistent. In other words, choose well what you're going to be tough about. Because if you're going to get tired of being tough about something about November, December, then you shouldn't have picked it to begin with if you decide it's not necessary. So stay with a very few. And I mentioned the few that I had. I will show respect to my teachers and my fellow students. I will talk only with permission. I will stay in my seat unless I have permission. And I don't remember the other two or three. The other two, I had five as a total. I had two more. Five simple rules. One was about maybe it was the respect one. Included respecting my surroundings. So I'm not going to write on. And I take some time. I'll get to that here in a minute. About how we define and explain and communicate these to students. And then letter F, consequence, not merely defined as punishment, but defined as consistent implementation of maximum positive reinforcement with minimal negative reinforcement. That's a lot of big words there. What are we saying? Well, consequences are not merely punishments, all right? Rather, the whole discipline program is focused toward a positive, encouraging atmosphere. I'm not a hawk watching for the next time somebody does something bad and I chop their hand off, you know. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is just that continual, positive, go for it, you can do it, let's do it right attitude in your classroom. And that will minimize how much negative you have to do. It really will. All right, well, how do we develop a strong discipline program? Well, here's nine steps. Number one, identify standards. And they encourage you to welcome parental involvement. You get a chance to talk to moms and dads and say, hey, what in your mind, what's the ideal classroom environment? How should a student behave? What should be expected of your child in my classroom? What do you think? It's interesting. Often they'll be tougher than you are. At least that was my experience. Now, maybe part of that is because they haven't been in a classroom. But it is nice to know that they'd be tougher than you are, rather than knowing they're out there thinking you're ridiculously tough. Simplify standards to three or four general classroom rules. I already talked about that. Three or four general rules. And here's something you could do. I haven't always done this, but you could do this if you do it in a positive way. Survey students to determine positive and negative consequences. In other words, find out what would be a good negative consequence or what would be a positive one. For us, in my school, for a couple years there, what I did for a combination of grades and behavior, I took people out to Pizza Hut for lunch. okay, for about once a quarter. And very interesting. I put a little bit of flex into it so that, and we had demerits. I don't use demerits anymore, but in those years I used demerits. And what we did, I said, if you have one demerit for the quarter, you can still go to Pizza Hut, but you pay $1 toward your lunch, okay? If you have two, you can still go, but you pay two. Three was the max they could have in a 9-week period, and they could pay $3. So they just about bought their lunch, okay? But they could still go, and they were excited about that. Four more demerits in a quarter, you couldn't go. Some people felt that was too much reward for not enough self-discipline. Some parents thought it was great. Other parents thought it was too easy. So it's good to talk to parents and students, find out what they think. Determine positive and negative consequences based on standards and student input. So we talked about surveying students, and then take a look at what you found out and make a list. And then display those class standards in the classroom along with a list of approved consequences from which effective consequences can be selected. Basically, what we're talking about there is that you need to explain to students, I may not give the same consequence for an offense every time, but I'm going to pull off that list. Okay, so they know ahead of time that you want some flexibility in what you implement. You're still the teacher. Number six, daily review discipline plan with class during the first 2 weeks of school. Explain that students may see different consequences for the same infraction. So those first 2 weeks, you're talking about what it means when you say that in this classroom, I will respect my teacher, my fellow students, and my surroundings. Explain what it means. When I first started teaching, that we had a list of 25 things. No students are allowed, da-da-da-da-da-da. No student should be found, da-da-da-da-da-da. Every student should... Okay, we had 25 of these, okay? And we'd spend time the first week of school going over these lists. No student is allowed out by the ditch along the school grounds. Okay, no student is allowed... Okay, all these things. No writing on bathroom partitions, you know. Well, why not say, I will respect my teachers, my fellow students, and my surroundings. I will respect the property and treat it like it is someone else's and not mine. And I always told them, I said, hey, look, your parents are paying for this school. When you deface property, you're taking money out of mom and dad's pocket. That's where it has to come from. And so, unless you have a very rebellious student, most students are not going to feel good about doing that. That's not the only reason. Just because it takes money out of somebody's pocket, it's also because it's right. But those first 2 weeks, you're spend time reinforcing those things. Number seven, meet with parents individually or collectively during the first 2 weeks of school. Explain your plan, answer their questions, obtain parents' written approval of the plan. Now, I have never obtained their written approval, but I have started inviting parents in for what I call parent orientation. And I would highly recommend that. Parents enjoy it. I was hesitant to do it because I was afraid parents would feel like it's one more night that we have to go away. But parents enjoy being in the know. And it's a way to start your school year off on a great start, because not only are your students taking home information about the new school year, yeah, the teacher said this, and we're going to have to do that this year, and you know how all the stories go. But mom and dad, you bring them in it, and you explain your program. And you don't have to just minimize it to the discipline. You can also talk about subjects, what kinds of things they can expect for homework, what kinds of things are going to happen in this subject, a project you have coming up in January. Every student should bring an old shirt for art. Okay, and it's just a whole list of things. I think, in fact, how many of you do that? Very few. You ought to start. It's priceless. I know it's a little intimidating. Invite all these parents in and tell them how I'm going to manage my classroom. You will have tremendous support, I believe, by communicating with parents this way. I cannot recommend it highly enough. If you can get them in, we have ours here August 18th. We've asked parents. Last year, I called every parent. I said, all right, can I plan on you being there? Okay? We need to have you here. We do really need to be able to meet, because that was my first year. And I wanted to be able to meet every parent and talk to them. They were all here except for one or two. Maybe three. So, really encourage them. Have some coffee and tea and cookies, you know, and enjoy the evening. But by explaining the program, I had to stay after school. Oh, well, that means you did this. Yeah. See, mom and dad already know why they have to stay after school. Tremendous benefit to communicate with parents on that level. Number 8. Implement your discipline plan. Now you're ready to put it into place. And be consistent every day with every child. Focus on praise and encouragement and address infractions firmly, fairly, and consistently. One of the things they say in this book, and I think someone mentioned it the other night here, that don't smile until Thanksgiving. And I've said the same thing as a teacher, but one of the things they've said in this book is that that's a myth of classroom discipline, that you shouldn't smile till Thanksgiving. Have a plan, communicate the plan, and go for it. Why can't you be a real person and smile the first day? But you have teeth behind the smile, you understand that? Okay. And then number 9, communicate student progress to parents regularly. Maximize opportunities to surprise parents with positive reports of their child. I don't know about you, but I always had students where it seemed I was calling mom and dad more often because of things that weren't going well than because of things that were going well. And so I began to make a real effort. This is tough. It maybe only happens several times a year. It's difficult. But I started calling parents periodically. Hey, I'm just calling. Call about supper time, you know, when everybody's there. And you call them and say, hey, I just want to let you know that Brad had a good day today in school. And I have just really appreciated his attitude the last week or two. You better do it quickly on some of those people. I appreciate his attitude today. Okay. Maybe your only chance for the next month. I'll leave it up here a little bit. But to call them and let them know, hey, that means a lot to a parent. Parents told me, hey, I really appreciate you calling. And, you know, it's kind of fun to imagine the conversation after they hang up. Who called? Who was that? Oh, that was, you know, Mr. Mull. Oh, what did he want? Oh, he just called to say that he just really appreciates how you're doing. Well, what about earning your students' respect? What about earning respect? One of the things they talk about in this book is the fact that a student cannot behave if there is no respect. And it's that thing we're talking about in this model by Ruth Beechick on the psychology of learning, that heart set, that response to discipline from mom and dad and later to the fear of the Lord. If a student does not respect himself or respect other people, why would he want to behave? He can't. He doesn't want to. Well, somehow you have to develop the respect, and I want to remind you that it grows out of that love and discipline. Of course, discipline should include the concept of love without having to add the word. But love and discipline. Okay, so I want to build respect in the student. And I want him to respect me. Well, I'm going to have to model it. I tell you, something that's just a pure joy, and I know I did not do this as a child, is to have my 3-year-old, when I ask him to do something, he goes, sure, Dad. And when he asked me, Dad, can you get me this? And I get it for him. He says, thanks, Dad. Okay. Now, that's just amazed me that a 3-year-old would say thanks. Okay, but you know why he does it? Because I do it to him. I say, Stuart, can you get me that? And he says, sure. And when he gives it to me, I say, hey, thanks, Stuart. And it just becomes a habit, becomes normal. You don't make a big fuss and gush about, oh, thank you. You know, that's okay, but if it's real, but just be real. Thank you. What's wrong with an honest thank you? Or a please? Or excuse me? When you're charging through the classroom door and you meet a student right there in the doorway, you're already halfway through. You think, well, I'll just go on through and let them. I still do this. Why not stop and back up and say, hey, go ahead. Excuse me. Oh, thank you. Model the respect. Give respect and it will be given to you. That's what I'm talking about. Give respect and it will be given to you. Be honest. Be honest. Be real. You don't have to pretend to be somebody you're not. You're not perfect. Everybody knows it, so why try to pretend you are? Sounds easy, doesn't it? Give children more than lip service love. Can you demonstrate that you care about them through doing something that takes your time, your energy? And remember that even though you think I'm sacrificing tremendously just because I'm teaching, I'm not getting paid much, I'm putting all this extra time in, can't they see I really want them to learn? But they see that as part of your job. That doesn't count. Now, they'll respect it later, if not sooner. They'll respect it. But what's going to count is a little extra mile stuff. Maybe planning an evening with your class. I'm thinking more junior high and high school, but it can be done with elementary as well. Planning an evening, arranging with parents, making sure everything's fine, letting them know what you're going to do, what time they'll be back, all those things. But plan a little evening and do another activity. Communicates love because it's outside of the line of duty. Cut children some slack. Let them be children. Enjoy them. Communicate, I like you. Discipline privately. I remember the day in first grade when the principal brought in or came in the room and said that one student had done some rather public display of misbehavior, and that student had to turn around and lean against the chalkboard and got three whacks with a big paddle. I was in first grade. It looked about that long. Okay. Well, I think we teachers have probably heard enough about not doing that kind of thing. I don't know that. How many of you ever seen that done? And you're okay. Number of you have. I'm not saying it's never appropriate, but generally, discipline privately. Not saying there shouldn't maybe be a public apology at times, but I like to discipline in private. Do a reality check on your expectations. Do a reality check on your expectations. And then be consistent. I think we're getting the point on that one. Be consistent. Reflects who you are. Number 9, seek out some background information on your students. And this can be fascinating. Remember that when you deal with a student, you deal with the whole person, but you only see them for 6-8 hours a day. And you see them at school. You don't know everything. I mean, you probably don't know everything about that student. Here again, you need to talk to mom and dad. Talk to the former teacher. Talk to the principal. Talk to the pastor. What do you know about this person? How can I help this person? You're not going after gossip. You're going after information that will help you be a better teacher and help you help this child. So seek out the background information on your students. Number 10, you have to spend the time if you want to earn their respect. You have to spend the time. It will not come automatically. You can't flip a coin. Number 11, be patient. Be patient. Some students, I had them for 2 and 3 years and never really felt I had their respect. I remember one student, I was telling my group here the other morning, I had one student who didn't enjoy hugs. And every so often, if I sensed students were feeling pretty lousy some morning in the devotional time, I would say, okay, before you leave the room, everybody has to hug somebody else. Of course, guys to guys and girls to girls. Everybody has to hug somebody else before you go. Okay, so everybody does. By the time everybody's, you can just tell it's kind of a tension reliever. And people are feeling better. But this guy, I would go around and hug a few people too. And this guy never really, he's just kind of real stiff, He just kind of, And I would at times come to a group of guys and put a hand on the shoulder or something. Whenever I did that to him, I only did it once or twice, because whenever I did it, he would go, very clearly did not like my hand on his shoulder. Well, I just never felt this guy. He was very cryptic, didn't have a lot to say, very sharp, intelligent guy, but very motivated, came from a good family, but did not like that. Well, it was interesting. Never felt I had a relationship with him the whole 3 years I had him in high school. I went home last Christmas, and who stops by at my parents-in-law's house when I'm there? He stops by just to say hi, I never have figured him out, okay? And even when he was there, he didn't have much to say. I was kind of sitting there, trying to talk. What shall we say? Number 12, practice positive humor. Practice positive humor. Again, I mentioned the first part of the week, sarcasm. Sarcasm does not work. Now, they may join in your humor and enjoy sarcasm, but if you will think and be alert a little bit, step back and reflect on the kinds of relationships and the kinds of discussions you get into with your students. Seldom will you get into a serious heart-to-heart chat about the real issues of their heart if you major on sarcasm. And I just tell you right out of experience, that's my story, because I love sarcasm. And I saw, though, that it did not develop in students. There was no pull for them to relate to me on a heart-to-heart level. And I didn't like that. I wanted to have a good relationship, but I saw that my sarcasm, we joked and laughed, but it kept us at a distance. I mean, how do I know that you're not going to say that kind of thing about me next time, That's what's communicated. So practice positive humor. And humor is a skill and a gift. It's an art. Good humor. To do it in a way that does not establish distance, but pulls people in, people feel invited, enjoyed. It's wholesome. Nothing like a good laugh. But it needs to be about the right things. Listen to them with complete attention. Complete attention. And this is tough too. You want to get back to your papers. You have something else to do. You have to rush off. How do you give them complete attention? And if you've, I think probably one of the best people, I had a couple of elementary teachers back home that were excellent at this. Probably the person I've seen do that well here is Melvin. He just does. If you've talked with him, you'll know what I mean. He gives you complete attention. And he's a very busy man, but he gives you complete attention when you talk to him. That's what I'm talking about there. Set your behavior guidelines early. Set your behavior guidelines early. Hit the ground running. First day of school, here's what we're talking about. And then be sure to follow through. There's that consistency thing again. Okay. I think I'll skip the break this morning. We get out that much earlier. Is that okay? Anybody, any opposed? Let's talk just a little bit about you. I presented some of this material in the chapel here this summer. So for 5 or 10 minutes here, if you heard it this summer, you'll get a little review. But I'd like for you to think about how you are developing. We've been talking about child development. Child development. And if I could just bring their names up one more time. Remember, Freud and Erikson looked at people developmentally. Okay? Well, I believe it's a scriptural model as well that we develop, not necessarily building on their model, but in using the term, we develop and grow. How does that take place? Are there some times, you know, in child development and certain week of the pregnancy, certain things happen? If it doesn't happen, it's messed up after that. In a young child's life, if they don't hear spoken language at a certain age, it becomes much more difficult. Okay, so if you miss something at a certain point, the idea is that maybe that's the best time for that to happen. Okay, well, I want to extend that a little bit into the adult life. And just going to suggest that maybe there are some best times for some things to happen in your adult life. Lifeline developmental phases. Okay, we've been majoring this week primarily on birth to 18. Birth to 18. Well, let's look at what happens after age 18. Here, you have the age of learning. And the key question is, who am I? What are some things that you need to give attention to in the time between 18 and 30? And I'm guessing most of you find yourself in that category. Maybe we should have taken a break here. I have people walking in. How many of you want a break? You want a break? A few of you do. Go for it. 10 minutes. I don't want to talk if you're not listening. Who has a copy of the learning styles? The learning styles. I made about 4 or 5 of them. Who has a copy of those? Okay, now there, one person requested a copy. You see the hands? I can't even find them. Okay, you see the hands that are up? Can you ask one of those people to make you a copy? Okay. All right, let's pick back up again on lifeline developmental phases here. And we're looking at ages 18 to 30. And we're calling it the age of learning. And the question is, who am I? Now think about this. We're calling 18 to 30 the age of learning. We've spent already the first 8, 10, 12 years, however many years you went to school, in school plus you were learning constantly as you grew in your physically, emotionally, spiritually. But we're calling this age of learning because now you move out into life. You're probably out from under, at least in a very direct way, you're out from under mom and dad. You're probably holding a job. You've maybe been away to some VS opportunities or going to school or whatever you've been doing. But we're calling this the age of learning. And the key question is, who am I? Now, you've been asking that question probably ever since you were 12, 14, 15 years old. Who am I? But the question becomes more significant as you try to make a decision about what you're going to do with your life. What is God calling me to do? What am I gifted to do? What does God have in mind for me? I think that's a question we all wrestle with. And that's what this period of life is looking at. Let me just tell you some things that I think are key. And this isn't original with me. Leighton Ford, you may have seen some of his writings for men. This is designed for men primarily. However, I think much of it is applicable for women as well. So, the question is, who am I? Number one, you need models. You need some people. Now, this is a very biblical idea. Paul said, older women should teach the younger, and we have fathers speaking to sons, and so on. However, my experience has been that not a lot of that happens by itself. Usually, you have to go looking for it. And if that has not been your experience, you need to thank the Lord, because I'd say you're a minority. Now, there's a lot of good teaching that happens. Don't hear me being too critical. A lot of good teaching that happens. What I'm looking at is one specific part, is this whole idea of modeling, that you have people, that you have heroes, if you want to call them that you look up to. So you need to find people. Okay, why am I drawn to that person? What is it about that person I admire? And how can I become like that? Or how can I take on some of those same qualities as that person? You need to find them. You need to develop understanding, especially about yourself. Develop understanding. Now, I'm not advocating here this morbid focus on self at the expense of other people. But if you don't know what you're like, you don't do very well in relationships, especially in teaching. You better know how you tend to respond in certain situations. You better know what kinds of people you tend to dislike because they'll be in your classroom. You better have some self-awareness there about how you tick in relation to people and to life and situations. Number three, you need perspective, affirmation, and feedback. Now, this is key. You know what my experience has been, and I'm going to assume that it's been true for you as well because you're teachers, and most of you, many of you are very young as teachers. That means that some people are putting a tremendous amount of confidence in you to spend time with their children. And why are they willing to do that? They probably see some things in you that they appreciate and are hopeful that you'll be able to do something good and positive in the lives of their young people and children. Now, you better think carefully about that. It's like Milo was talking about this morning. You need some feedback. You need to understand that you may not do everything well. Now, you need some perspective. In other words, I can't change the world by myself. Okay, that's fundamental. But there is also this need of affirmation. I hope you have somebody in your life who's willing and able to tell you, you know, you did well. You did well on that talk, or you do a really good job as a teacher. My child really enjoys your class. Okay? You need to hear those things. If you never hear that, you better pause. Find somebody who is willing to give you that kind of feedback. You need it. You really do. Feedback. So you give a talk or you are in charge of some committee or you head up some kind of activity, you're teaching in a classroom, you're involved in a youth group, whatever. After it's over, ask somebody, how did I do? If I could do something better, what would I do? What would you recommend that I do better? And I am very... if I can use the word, covetous of friends that I have who are willing to do this for me, who are willing to tell me when I don't do well and tell me when I do well. Not so that I get cocky about it, but so that I can hang on to what I did well. And so I don't maybe in discouragement give up that and try something else. But if I did well on that, that's a clue perhaps into what God is calling me to do. Because I'm going to say that what you're good at is a good clue as to what God is going to call you to do. Okay, now maybe fairly general, some things you're good at, and it could apply in different vocations. But what you're good at is going to be a clue. Where people give you feedback and affirmation, you need to perk up. Okay, so I did well there. Okay, so I wonder, maybe if they're a good enough friend, so what did you like about it? What felt really good? Can you identify what was good about it? It will give you some clues, I think, as to what God is calling you to do. So that is key. Inner life issues. You cannot spend enough time getting to know God, developing your relationship with Him, understanding where your spiritual passions and drives and energies are headed. It's interesting to me to note that Jesus, you know, what did he do the first 30 years of his life? Okay? That's why I like this model, because the question is, who am I? Up till the time I'm 30, approximately, I need to be settling some of these core issues, because your ministry and responsibility will only increase as you get older. If it decreases, it's because something was not in place back here. That's what I want to suggest. And then you need accountability. You need people who are willing and able to listen to the darker side of your life and your heart. And I think everyone ought to have one friend that knows some of the darkest thoughts that you think, that enter your mind, especially men. I cannot emphasize that enough. You need to find one or two brothers who can sit and listen and hear you tell your temptations, your struggles, your joys, things you're excited about, what you think God is doing in your life, where He's calling you, good and bad. Somebody needs to know what's on your heart. And I think that goes for women as well. One reason it's so critical for men is because you're going to be in leadership. And if you hide all of that and you develop a pattern of hiding those things, it'll pop out in some nasty situations. And you won't be able to predict them always when they'll come out. But all of a sudden, you'll be in trouble. Number six is unbusy. Unbusy. And here's what I'm talking about. You're all teachers. Many of you are very young compared to, you know, the person that's taught for 15, 20 years. Okay? And you're there because people think you have some potential. Now, it's easy for people to say, hey, get so-and-so to do it. Yeah, he's a good guy. He's great, motivated, energetic. Go for it. Give it to him. He'll take care of it, or she'll take care of it. And they can teach, and they can be in charge of this activity and be on that committee, and you're just going for it. You know, and I get the picture sometimes, you know, you just pant like a dog. I can do that. What next? You know, and they're just going all over the place, full of energy and idealism and ideas, all these things. They're going for it. The problem is they haven't paused long enough to deal with some inner life issues. They don't stop long enough to develop some really strong relationships with a few people. They have lots of friends, lots of people they know. They go to Pennsylvania and Ohio and Indiana and Florida, and they know everybody every place, you know. Well, be careful. Make sure that you have one or two or three people that know you very, very well, and that you are unbusy enough to spend time with God, develop that relationship, and develop a few other good, strong relationships. You know what else is happening here on a very practical level? What's happening here is that you're getting a job. You're trying to be equipped for doing that job. You're trying to save some money. You're probably trying to buy a house. If you get married, you're starting a family. You're very busy on a very practical side. And if you don't take care of those things, it could lead to problems later on. And so it's not until you get into your 30s, 40s, and 50s, perhaps. People are different. Life situations vary, but we're talking in broad categories here. 30 to 50, that perhaps you're able to contribute more. Think about that. You may think you're pouring out all you have right now, but by God's grace, you should be able to contribute more as you get older. And the key question here is, what do I do? Some people, especially when you talk about midlife crisis, I think comes often from people who perhaps did not do very well in that first section we talked about. Of course, I can say that I haven't experienced midlife crisis yet. If I will, who knows? Okay. Age of contribution, key question. What do I do? What are some issues? Pressures. As a parent, pressures increase. Now, I know that Marie and I, we sat down as young married. And we said that one of the things we're not going to do in our family, we're never going to raise our voices or yell at our children. We're just not going to do that. It's just not necessary. Well, I tell you, when I moved out here last fall, I was trying to sell my business back home. I was trying to move, and it was hot. We had air conditioning at home. We didn't have it here. And it was hot, and there were a lot of people I didn't know, people I thought I needed to impress. And I had to be a certain kind of person. And the pressure was intense. My office was gutted because they were renovating it. My house, the weekend that school started, the Saturday before school started, they came up and ripped out two bedrooms, you know. Started building a wall for the bathrooms. Okay, so my life was in a grand state, as Milo would say, a grand state of confusion. There was pressure. I had to get ready for classes that I'd never taught. It was pressure. I raised my voice. I don't like the word yelled, but that's what it was. I raised my voice at my children more during that time. It was just pressure. and they increase. It's easy to say when there's no pressure, no children around. And my first child was not a difficult child. He was pleasant. Second was much more intense, and he brought something out of me I didn't know was there. Halftime. Halftime. Second thoughts. You may, if you're one of those people that are busy, go-getters, do it all, I can handle it, sure, I can do it. You may come to a point and say, wait a minute, I haven't done any one thing for more than 3 years since I've been 20. Okay, what am I doing? Where am I headed from here? Okay, during that halftime, you may have some second thoughts. And I want to jump here, number four, you need some coaching. Find some good people who you have seen that do well, who know you well, and say, hey, look, lay it all out. What should I be doing? What should I be looking at? What should I be considering? And then here are some dangers. Number three, some of the dangers are that you can either dabble or plateau. And especially as men, I think we do this. We either dabble or we plateau. We've been crunching hard all this time. We've been learning how to do things. And we learned some things. We got pretty good at a few things, maybe. And we think we pretty much got it together. And so we plateau. We stop learning. We stop getting better. We stop growing. Or we dabble. We just continue. Well, I do this for a while. I do this for a while. I know men that have had 5, 6, 7 different vocations. And they've told me at 50 years of age, they say, you know, there's just this continual sense of unrest. But you may need coaching, and you need to further focus on life purpose and message. God, what am I to do? Why am I here? I love the story of Dr. Paul Brand, who was the famous hand surgeon in India in the leprosy colonies. He was 40 years old before he went. And before that time, he was a mechanic for a while. He worked in construction for a while. He did all kinds of things, construction, plumbing, wiring. I mean, he was so frustrated with his life. He said, God, what in the world am I supposed to do? He'd do something for a while and change. 40 years of age, he went to med school, went to India as a medical missionary in the leprosy colonies, and pioneered some amazing surgical techniques for reconstructing hands. And because of his engineering ability, because he was construction, mechanical things, he was very good with his hands, and he had some insights, and creativity was possible because of all of his experiences. And he became known as a famous surgeon on hands. Now, did his life make sense? Sure. It took a while. So I'm saying, don't get locked into the categories. God may have a grand design that you don't know, but you need to be thinking about, what is my life purpose and message? He also found out he had to do things like build the mission hospital, fix the mission jeep. He could do it because he had all those experiences. And 50 and plus is the age of investment. And the question there is, invest in whom? Invest in what? I just know, and it's a tragedy, I'm not being critical here, it's a tragedy. I know too many older men, and who's to say I won't be one of them one day? Too many older men that somehow have dropped out of the race, and they don't have anything to say to the people younger than they. I don't want to be one of those. But it's about finishing well. It's about leaving a legacy. It's about coping with changes in life. You never know what life is going to throw at you. You never know. How are you going to deal with it? And how are you going to do it and stay on top? And it's about having relationships. Steve Brubaker was here for the summer. We were talking about this, and he said, you know, I've noticed the men in my church, the older men, you'll see them talk, you'll hear them talk about a good friend they had for years. And when they happen to get together with that friend, you can sense that there was something there. There was a spark. There was a friendship there. But somehow, nobody makes any efforts to maintain the relationship. It just kind of dribbles off. Okay, that's what I'm talking about, relationships. Don't let it happen. You need them if you're going to finish strong. You cannot become isolated from people. I've seen older men just bury themselves in their own immediate family. It's great. They often have nice families, but there's something missing there when there's not other good men in their life. Well, we're done. I want to share with you one little passage. As we close, share with you a scripture passage that Melvin shared with me over the past winter, and it resonated with me because it brought together several issues that I felt very strongly about. Mark chapter 1. Let me bring a couple issues into focus as we think about this passage. Remember, we talked about the fact that how can you, if you're a young person, how can you hope to give anybody any advice or counsel in their marriage or family? You're single, you're 20, 19, 25, whatever. How are you supposed to be able to say anything to this family or into this marriage? Okay, so I'm thinking about that as I read this passage. I'm thinking about the students in my classroom who have tremendous needs. And I really don't have a clue as to how to meet those needs. I'm thinking about being able to stand up in front of my classroom and teach with some enthusiasm, to teach with some fervor, to teach with energy, to have some vision. I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about having enough heart and love in my heart to care for the students that I don't really like. Those are the issues that I have in mind as I look at this passage. Mark 1, verse 12. And immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness, and he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted of Satan, was with the wild beasts, and angels ministered unto him. You know what Satan's questions were to Jesus in the temptation? If you are the Son of God. He was challenging Jesus' identity. What was the question in ages 18 to 30? Who am I? Who am I? You need to settle that question. Jesus had it settled. He wasn't deterred from who he was and from his mission. But that was the temptation. If you are. Now after that, John was put into prison. Verse 14. Jesus came into Galilee, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God, and saying, the time is fulfilled, and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent ye and believe the gospel. Now as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. And Jesus said unto them, come ye after me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. And straightway they forsook their nets and followed him. And when he had gone a little farther thence, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the ship mending their nets. And straightway he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the ship with the hired servants and went after him. And they went into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority, and not as the scribes. And there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, let us alone. What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee who thou art, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, hold thy peace, and come out of him. And when the unclean spirit had torn him and cried with a loud voice, he came out of him. And they were all amazed, insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what thing is this? What new doctrine is this? For with authority commandeth he even the unclean spirits, and they do obey him. And immediately his fame spread abroad throughout all the region round about Galilee. And forthwith, when they were come out of the synagogue, they entered into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. But Simon's wife's mother lay sick of a fever, and anon they tell him of her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. And immediately the fever left her, and she ministered unto them. And at even, when the sun did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased, and them that were possessed with devils. And the city was gathered together at the door. The city was gathered at the door. And he healed many that were sick of divers diseases, and cast out many devils, and suffered not the devils to speak, because they knew him. And in the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out, and he departed into a solitary place, and there prayed. And Simon and they that were with him followed after him. And when they had found him, they said unto him, all men seek for thee. And he said unto them, let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, for therefore came I forth. And he preached in their synagogues throughout all Galilee, and cast out devils. And there came a leper to him, beseeching him, and kneeling down to him, and saying unto him, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put forth his hand and touched him. Notice Jesus touched a leper, a man who was ceremonially unclean. But Jesus touched him and saith unto him, I will, be thou clean. And as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy departed from him, and he was cleansed. And he straightly charged him, and forthwith sent him away, and saith unto him, see thou say nothing to any man, but go thy way. Show thyself to the priest, and offer for thy cleansing those things which Moses commanded, for a testimony unto them. But he went out and began to publish it much, and to blaze abroad the matter, insomuch that Jesus could no more openly enter into the city, but was without in desert places, and they came to him from every quarter. I want to notice something in this passage. Jesus had a relationship with God the Father. And I'm going to suggest that we need the same things I want to present to you here. That Jesus had a relationship with God the Father. Notice that he spent time with the Father. We see it in verse 12 when he was in the desert 40 days. We see it in verse 35 when he went a great while before day. C.S. Lewis, in his book Paralandra, it's in his adult fiction trilogy. But in the book Paralandra, it's sort of an allegory of another planet. And there is no sin on this planet. And the man, who's a professor at a university, they somehow get to this planet. He's the unman. Lewis calls him the unman, the opposite of a true man. He basically tries to deceive the woman on this island. Tries to corrupt her. And she's a beautiful lady. And she's not wearing anything. And just like Eve. And so he is walking alongside. He has this mirror. He wants her to look into the mirror. And she makes the comment. She says, I've never entered into the life or into the alongside. Into the alongside. In other words, an awareness, stepping outside of ourselves. How many times do you stand in front of the classroom and find yourself thinking, I think I look pretty stupid right now? Or I think I'm not doing well at all right now. Okay? It's like you're standing over, you're watching yourself. And you're evaluating, and there are negative thoughts, perhaps evil thoughts, coming in. And you're standing here watching it all happen, kind of outside of yourself. But in here, in her sinless condition, she is not aware of the alongside, because she is completely operating out of her knowledge of the Father, God the Father, the Creator. She is only aware of his presence and what he wants to do through her. And I think that's what we want to see here, is that we do not want to be alongside ourselves. The temptation is there. And how do we do that? I think that we practice the presence. How many of you read the book by Brother Andrew, Practicing the Presence of Christ? A few of you? Okay. I think therein lies the secret. And we call it a practicing the presence. In other words, it's an act of faith. When you consciously say, Jesus, I'm going to live right now in your presence. I want to allow you to minister through me. And I'm going to walk down the hall. I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to get up and go to work. I'm going to step in front of my classroom in the presence of Christ. It's an act of submission and faith right there, because you do it in his presence. Relationship. I don't know how I got Jesse's. It was late when I typed this. Out of this relationship grew Jesus' authority. Okay? Jesus' authority. Notice what the people said about Jesus when he taught. When he taught, they said, this is different. This person has an authority. He knows what he's talking about. What he says has weight. Don't we all want weight in our classrooms? We want our students to say, wow. Well, I'm not suggesting ulterior motives here at all, but I'm going to say that Jesus' authority grew out of his relationship with the Father. And notice how he pursued it. The whole city was at the door. You can't tell me after ministering to people for that long, that intensely, that he wasn't exhausted emotionally. But he rose up a great while before day the next morning, went out, and spent time with the Father. He knew where his strength came from. And I'm going to suggest to you, this didn't look like some pious, pharisaical, ultra-righteous, perfect representation. I'm going to say that Jesus was very, very much a real person. He was a man. But his authority, Isaiah 53 says, when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. I don't believe Jesus was the ultimate He-Man. I think he was a normal kind of guy. But he was God in the flesh. And even he, if you ever get a chance to read a book, Secret of the Christian Life by Gene Edwards, and his whole premise in that book is that no human being can live the Christian life. Even Jesus on earth could not live the Christian life. He says, I do only the will of my Father. So only Jesus in you can live the Christian life. You can't live it. Jesus in you can. And when you operate in his presence, you can live the Christian life. Out of his authority came a healing ministry. Jesus never went and hung a shingle on the door and said, healer of diseases, answerer of all questions. You know, he didn't say that. He just got out and began to relate to people. And as he ministered to people, there developed around him a healing ministry, the crowds. And we end this chapter in Mark with the words, and they came to him from every quarter. All around, they came to him. Well, what does a healing ministry look like? John Wesley said, he says this, and let me just challenge you a bit. I don't consider myself a charismatic person. But let me challenge you with a quote from John Wesley. John Wesley said that the reason that the miraculous gifts were so quickly withdrawn, if I can remember it now, I didn't read this recently. The reason they were so quickly withdrawn was not that they weren't needed anymore or necessary, but he says the reason is that dry, formal, orthodox men began to cry down whatever gifts they had not themselves. They were critical of others who demonstrated them, and they began to cry down whatever gifts they had not themselves. Now, let me just suggest that healing ministry is not only a physical healing ministry, but it is a whole person. And so when you have a healing ministry, remember Jesus came to offer salvation. What's the root word? Salvation. Salvage. Same root word as salvation. Salvage. He came to restore. Romans talks about that. The whole creation groans and travails, waiting for the final restoration. Jesus started it in you and me. And he wants to continue that. Remember, he called the disciples in this chapter. Come after me, I will make you fishers of men. We could paraphrase and say, I will make you able to have a healing ministry. Come follow me. And so that wherever Jesus went, there was restoration, there was reconciliation, there was a salvaging process going on. Whatever was wrong was made right. Jesus wants to continue this healing ministry through you and me. Wherever we go, there ought to be the sense that something is right. When people talk to you, they say, you know, there's something about that, something's right about that person. Not perfect, not perfect, real, right. There's something right about this person. Something is being restored. And when you talk to people, things that are out of place, things that are twisted, things that are broken, are put back in place. Not because you're so intelligent, not because you're right, but because you know the healer himself. And you have a relationship with him. It's about identifying people who feel they have no ability. How many of those are in your classroom? People who feel they have no ability, and you can walk alongside them and you can say things like, God's going to use you. I can tell. God's going to use you. I can tell. Well, the exciting thing about this is that Paul does the same thing in the Thessalonians, with the Thessalonians. In the first chapter, he talks about this. Verse 2, we always thank God for all of you, mentioning you in our prayers. We continually remember you before God and Father, your work produced by faith, your labor prompted by love, and your endurance inspired by hope in our Lord Jesus Christ. He talks about how when he went to Thessalonians, how they became imitators of Paul and of the Lord. And they became a model to all the believers. And in chapter 2, he talks about being a father to them, being a mother to them, being a nurse to these people. People that didn't have spiritual fathers, people that didn't have Christian homes, people that were broken and twisted and messed up. And Paul ministered to them just like a father, just like a mother, just like a nurse. Well, this is about following Jesus with every fiber of your soul. It's going to cost you. It's about saying, it's not about me, it's about him. It's not about me, it's about him. It's about being real. It's more about God's power than my near holiness. I'm not saying holiness doesn't matter. I'm not saying we don't pursue it with everything within. But it's not so much about us being nearly holy, so now we can work for God. No, it's more about God's power than it is your near holiness. It's about loving God. It's about developing our students. We nurture them. We train them. We believe in them. We release them. And we remember them. We don't forget them. We leave them with a little phrase ringing in their ears, God's going to use you. I can tell. Famous quote by Teddy Roosevelt, the credit belongs to the persons who are actually in the arena, who strive valiantly, who know the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, and spend themselves in a worthy cause, who at the best know the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if they fail, at least fail while daring greatly, so that their place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. Let's pray. Jesus, we long to operate totally and completely in your presence, and yet we so often step into the alongside, and we second guess ourselves, and we doubt, and we fear. Help us to know you. Help us to follow you. Give us a hunger and a desire to know you and to allow you to work through us. To be all that you say you are, Lord, a healer, a provider, a warrior, a savior, a redeemer. Help us, Lord, to carry all of that into our classrooms. I pray for each of these people here that you would enable them, they would reach out to you, and that they would walk in your presence. And Lord, do a work. We live in a hungry, hurting, angry world. Oh God, we need wisdom. We need insight. We need strength. We feel so small in the face of all the wickedness and depravity and need and hurt around us. Father, help us. I pray that we could allow you to live within. We just invite you afresh and anew today, Jesus, to come into our hearts like you promised you would with the Father. You'd come and dwell in us and make your home in us. Help us to live in light of that and to know it with all our hearts. And I pray that you be with each person as they travel home. Would you keep them safe and enable them, equip them in their callings? And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.